fluoride compound, and I'll be introducing the other work that's been done in the field on the system. Okay. This is my group over here. The work that I'm presenting is primarily Jeff Trilliam's thesis work for his master's thesis and his PhD. I'd like to thank all collaborators also, Gomez and Kicha, my brother. They did a very important X-ray characterization of the material to make sure that we're studying a well-defined and understood material. And also thanks to Michelle Gingra and Graham Luke for very helpful discussions. Okay, so lithium holmium yttrium fluoride is a material which is produces these holmiums have an Ising moment, and there's a distribution of the holmiums within a unit cell, which gives you either an antiferromagnetic or a ferromagnetic interaction, depending on the which neighbors you're looking at. And what's nice about this system is that we can replace the yttriums, the holmiums, which are magnetic, with yttrium, not distort the lattice, and dilute the moments, and change the level of disorder in the system, and also and get frustration. Up and down. Right. Thanks. Okay, so this is the phase diagram that's been developed for this, and Reich et al. Did this work, this phase diagram, in 1990, and they proposed that this would be a very interesting system to study as well, because it is a kind of an ideal Ising system that you can dilute with and study frustration. And so what you can see from this is that you have a ferromagnetic transition when you have 100% concentration of holmium, and then as you dilute it, the ferromagnetic transition decreases with concentration until you get into this more dilute region where you get a spin glass transition at lower temperatures. And then over here, it was observed something unusual, which they call an anti-glass. And it doesn't look like this is acting like a spin glass anymore. And I'm going to describe more carefully in detail what's happening or what that looks like. And so what I'm showing you here, actually most of these works are from Rosenbaum's group. Menenga, I think, is the only paper that I've referred to in here that's not from Rosenbaum's group for this 100% concentration in the ferromagnetic transition. But they've seen many different types of physics in different parts of this phase diagram. There's a lot of interesting physics that occurs with a transverse field. And in this region over here, and there are theorists that have been working a lot in this system as well, including Michelle Gingra and Stamp and Henelius. These are groups that have been doing a lot of the physics for the part that we're interested in. I'll be talking about the concentration down here, and I'll be talking about work that we're doing in a zero transverse field. So the 16% material is a spin glass over here, and I'll be talking about the lower concentration. So the 16% actually has gotten a lot of attention recently, because there's now a debate on whether that's even a spin glass. And so the Reich work presented it as a spin glass. And also there's work with Wu, in another paper by Wu, this is also Rosenbaum, which looked at the chi-3. It's the nonlinear term in susceptibility, and also worked with transverse fields, showing that you can remove the spin glass transition with a field with due to quantum effects. And so then what happens is, so they're saying, yes, it's a spin glass. Snyder and Yu has a theory work that for a square lattice, slightly different, but showing it with dilution, that maybe there would be no spin glass transition temperature, finite temperature. And then Janssen later in 2007 did squid susceptible or magnetization work and found no spin glass transition. And then this is Rosenbaum's group, which said, yes, it is spin glass again. And then this is theory work, which is saying, yes, there's spin glass. So this is the original work by Reich showing the phase diagram again, and then the specific heat, and then AC susceptibility as a function of frequency, showing the characteristics that would explain or describe this as a spin glass. This is the specific heat. What you see here is their specific heat data, and underneath is a faint line, which is the nuclear background from the holmium. And so what happens is you have to do a subtraction of that. So just look at the magnetic component, and then it ends up looking very similar, actually. But this is the specific heat Schottky behavior you'd expect for a spin glass. Now, this is the spin glass behavior you'd expect above the spin glass transition. There's a rule of thumb that a spin glass transition temperature could be about 80% of this peak temperature. And so this is a kind of a good way to, well, this is consistent with a spin glass, but it's not really proof. The susceptibility is a better way of looking at that. And what you see here is the chi prime and chi double prime. The susceptibility chi prime is a standard susceptibility, while chi double prime is looking at the dissipation or the absorption. It's related to the phase lag of the magnetic moments. And what you can see is as they're cooling this system, they're seeing that this is going to lower and lower frequencies, which is saying the general time scale of the of relaxation is getting lower and lower. By normalizing that in frequency and in amplitude, you can end up getting a distribution like this, which looks at the distribution of the barriers to relaxation. And it's showing here that as you cool it, the system is getting broader. And that's consistent with a spin glass. What Reich et al. Did was they did a scaling analysis of this, and they to this behavior for a spin glass, and they can calculate that or predict that a spin glass transition temperature of 100 millik fits this with an exponent, which is 7, which is very reasonable for a spin glass, and they find a time constant of about 2 milliseconds. Okay, so now for the end, and I'll get to the other results on this material later. I'm kind of going in chronological order. So here is the 4.5%, which we can call, they would call an anti-glass. And I'm showing here the 16% specific heat as well as the 4.5%. And what you can see here now is the specific heat is doing something very unusual. There's a peak in the specific heat, or it's almost tracking similarly to what the 16% is doing. But then all of a sudden, the contribution of the electron magnetic moments disappears, and it goes to zero specific heat. And so when you do the background subtraction of the nuclear term, you can see a peak here. It goes almost to zero, and then it's kind of cutting back up again. And so this is something very unusual that it would not be expected from a spin glass. In the susceptibility, what they see is actually something also very unusual, and that is that instead of broadening of these of the width, when you look at this in terms of this normalized description, you see that it's actually narrowing as you cool it. And so then that's why they're calling it an anti-glass. But it's also unusual that at the higher frequencies that this is perfectly all matched. There's no temperature dependence to the susceptibility, this chi double prime, when it's normalized in this range. Another thing they looked at, and this is just a characterization, is showing that the static susceptibility, so this is looking at the susceptibility at low frequencies, is tracking as 1 over the temperature down to low temperatures. And so this is the 16%, 16% and the 4.5%. Okay, so now in 2002 and 2003, new results from the Rosenbaum group came out where they remeasured the susceptibility of the 4.5% sample. As far as I know, it's the same exact sample. And what they found was that this temperature dependence in the susceptibility now is 3/4 instead of t to the minus 1, it's t to the minus 0.75. And then they've added, this is the same specific heat data as before, but they've added 5 more points over here and showing that there's actually a second peak, and it wasn't just a continuous upturn. And so what the result in this paper says is that points out is that it's very unusual to have peaks in a specific heat and then not have no features in the susceptibility. Another thing they did was they analyzed this, and they interpreted this as an evidence of quantum mechanical entanglement of the magnetic moments. And a thing that they were pointing to is that there could be also clusters of magnetic moments occurring. That's shown over in here, where they see hole burning effects. And what they're saying is that this hole burning effect, by applying a transverse field at 5 hertz and then looking at the susceptibility, they see a dip in the absorption spectrum. And that would be consistent with coherent spin oscillations of clusters at 260 spins. over here, the susceptibility data is taken over again. This is what came from there. And what you can see is at low temperatures, it becomes very asymmetric, this chi double prime. Okay. And they're seeing also, this is the peak frequency of the susceptibility, and they're seeing it deviate as 1 over T at lower temperatures, which is saying that, they're saying that this is a quantum to classical phase transition. Okay, so our first goal was to look at the specific heat. And so what we wanted to do is measure the specific heat accurately for many different compounds, including the 4.5, to be able to see whether these peaks were concentration dependent, and also whether there was some problem with maybe the subtraction of this nuclear term. And so we got a bunch of compounds from a group in Russia that they gave us these different, they sold us these different compounds. About a cubic centimeter of material costs $400, so it's very cheap. This material is used for lasers, just like a neodymium YAG. There's a holmium yttrium lithium fluoride laser. And so they make very high quality crystals for that application. And so what we did was we have these different compounds. We're going to try to map out the phase diagram in this region. And so this is our specific heat setup. What we did was we customized this measurement to be optimized for this spin glass system. The idea is that if it's a spin glass, it could have very slow relaxation times. And so we should make sure that the time constants of the heat capacity measurement should be very long. And so we set up a measurement that would have a time constant for the thermal relaxation that would be on the order of hours. And we also set up a way where we would make sure that we're not losing any of the heat. We have good control and understanding of where the heat's going. And so we set up something where we have a sample, and then we have weak thermal links made out of niobium titanium over here. And then we glue the thermometer. Actually, I can just show it over here. That's the schematic of this. We have a sample over here. We suspend it off of strands of dental floss. It's actually shreds of dental floss. So the dental floss would produce too much heat flow. And so it's little fibers from that. And then we have this niobium titanium wires that go to this resistive thermometer that's been polished down to avoid the alumina. And then we have a heater that's a resistive heater with wires. And these niobium titanium wires, I'm actually, we used a trick that my supervisor, Bill Halperin, who will be talking later today, told me about. And it's a nice trick that ends up being very useful here. We take a fine wire of niobium titanium multi-core wire that's a standard magnet wire, and we etch away the copper cladding. And so a so about a 75 micron diameter wire contains about 60 or 30, depending on the manufacturer, of these very fine niobium titanium wires. So then we extract those, and that gives us 6 micron diameter niobium titanium wires that we can then glue down onto here with silver epoxy. And so that ends up giving us an extremely weak thermal heat flow because it's superconducting with a high TC, and gives us this 2-hour time constant. The other advantage of this measurement, a standard way to people do these measurements is they have a substrate. So this would be maybe a sapphire disk, and they'd have their thermometer just like this, and then they would plop down their sample. That's the way that the Rosenbaum group does it. I didn't like this method as much because what happens is if we look at this kind of schematic, if this was a substrate now and we glue a sample on top of it, it would be sitting, let's say, above here. What happens is the heat can go into the substrate and then out the weak link and not get into the sample. And so you'll end up having the heat won't get into the specific, into the sample, and you'll have a miscalculation of your specific heat. Also, you can end up, this is another point, that it's very important to have a very good asymmetry in this thermal link here, because if this thermal conductivity and this thermal conductivity are equal, this temperature will be half of the temperature, it'll be halfway between these two points. And so this point here has to be a very good connection compared to that. And so these very fine wires ensure that. And so this is an example of one of our heat pulses. We have our sample sitting at here at just under 100 millik, and then we give a heat pulse that's controlled that warms it up by about 4 millik, and then it relaxes. And so we can see here that we have a very nice thermal equilibration time for the sample and the thermometer, and then this thing will then slowly relax back to this temperature with hours of time constant. And so what we do is we understand the amount of heat we put in, and we measure the delta T, and then that gives us a specific heat. We then move to new temperatures and then do these steps across the range. And so this is what our specific heat looks like for three different concentrations of this holmium-based material. And so what we can see here is that we've got something similar to, this is a nuclear term here, and then we have these nice smooth peaks. And so the 4.5% is not going to see evidence of these double peaks that the Rosenbaum group saw. That's the 4.5%. The 1.8 is just lower. If we now also do the subtraction, what we see is the Schottky behavior for the 8%, which is consistent with the spin glass, but so is the same for the 4.5% and the 1.8% concentrations. Now, what we would expect for a spin glass, if this 80% rule of thumb works, is that if this is the peak here, we would think the glass transition could be around there, and then this one over here, this peak should have shifted over. So that's one unusual thing we're seeing, is that this peak is not shifting to lower temperatures, and this one as well. This is normalized to holmium, and so we're seeing a drop in specific heat as well. And let me go here. What we did here was we're integrating and calculating the change in entropy. And so what we can see from these two, the three different concentrations, is that the entropy is not accounted for when in these lower concentrations. What we did was we extrapolated, assuming spin glass has a linear temperature dependence, we extrapolated to zero temperature, and then we find that we have all of the entropy accounted for the 8%, but we don't get all the entropy accounted for or with this type of extrapolation for the lower concentrations, which is saying that either there's a residual entropy in the system or this extrapolation method isn't correct. And so this is a work by...
Yeah, it's a too low an extrapolation, the green and the red one. So the last left point is that they're about, what, 80 Kelvin or something like that?
Yes.
Right,
right, that's right. It's really not the greatest thing to be doing. Maybe that was, that's, I was going to say, is something we did was we just assumed linear. And okay, there's a couple of things. If we have a peak over here, then the glass transition is here, so we should be justified to go with linear if that was really the case, right? But if that rule of thumb is not very reliable, then we're not justified in going with linear. And so what happens is there's a paper by Snyder and Yu that came in just before our results, which has a square lattice or a cubic lattice and does a Monte Carlo simulation. And what it's saying is that there'd be no spin glass transition below a 20% dilution of, let's say, the holmiums. Now, this is not the same kind of a lattice. It doesn't have the same angles of interaction. And I think that someone like Michelle could probably make more comments about details of that work. But just to say that they are saying that there would be a residual entropy that would be expected in this system with lower concentrations. And so we're seeing a qualitative agreement with what they were seeing. So, looking at a comparison with what the Reich work and shows is that what we see is that at high temperatures, we have good agreement with their works. This is their 16% concentration, and this is their 8. But at lower temperatures, this is coming down. And so there also, one thing I should have mentioned is that if you look at the entropy that's in their 16%, it's not all accounted for like we have in our 8%. So our 8% is kind of a nice consistency. If this is a spin glass and this is this linear approximation seems to be correct, then we're getting all of the entropy, and they don't with their 16%. And then these peaks, we're not seeing that. Okay, so then this is something at lower temperatures we see, and that is, you know, why do we stop at, let's say, 80 millik or 90 millik? And what happens is at these very low temperatures. Let's say we're at, well, not very low, but let's say even 70 millik, what we're doing here is we're applying heat for this period of time over here, and we see that the thermometer warms up to this point, and then we turn it off, it then relaxes down to here. And what we see is that there's a decoupling of the lattice with another contribution of the specific heat. So this would now be the diagram. We have the refrigerator here. We've got our sample, which is these heat capacities here. We're putting the heat through a glue contact of the heater to the sample. And so that's most likely going straight into the phonon part. And then there's a coupling between the electronic term and the nuclear term. And the nuclear term we know has a very large heat capacity. And we don't know what these links are. But as we go to low temperatures, what we're seeing is more like this is effectively like this substrate style of heat capacity measurement, where the thermometer is now warming up to this point, and the heat is leaking into these terms over here. When we turn off the heat, these now re-equilibrate, and then now this is now relaxing with the, let's say, 2-hour time constant back to the reservoir temperature. And so this means that we have to be very careful about how we would do the specific heat in this range. And so the data I've shown, we're not including things where this is a strong effect. And so what happens is the amount of heat that's actually getting into the sample might not be completely accurate. But the amount of heat going into CN, for example, would not be accurate because some of the this part here is getting hot, and so the heat flow through this connection is actually enhanced in this time period. And so this is what we see at low temperatures. We can see this time constant of this relaxation changing. And so what that's saying is that some kind of the specific heat of, let's say, the lattice, which is a smaller specific heat, and the link between the lattice and, let's say, the nuclei or the electronic term, this part here is becoming significant. Okay. So in conclusion, for the specific heat part of the work, is that we measured these terms over here. We these different concentrations. We had a residual entropy estimate for the lower concentrations. Definitely the 0.08 looked like a spin glass. These didn't exactly look like a spin glass in that the peak of the specific heat didn't go down in temperature as we would have expected, and there's a residual entropy. So these are maybe not as well understood, but they're smooth characteristics, and we're not seeing the peaks that the Rosenbaum group saw. And so this is referred to in this paper. Okay, so now I'll talk about the susceptibility measurements.
Wow.
I've got very little time. Okay, so what happens here, I'm gonna have to probably go over by 5 minutes, and I think I'll be okay. But what we have here is this is the Rosenbaum work. This is from Gosch's thesis, and so you can see the asymmetry as I was mentioning. And what we're doing is we're setting up a susceptibility measurement for that. Now, what the Rosenbaum group uses is a inductive pickup coil. And so this is a schematic of this. And this is something we've set up in our lab as well to do this measurement. But we then moved away from that because we found that it did not have a flat frequency response. At high frequencies, there's an intercoil resonance that ends up changing your phase. So you mix up your chi prime and your chi double prime. And also your gain is wrong. And at low frequencies, because this is an inductive pickup coil, it goes off of induced EMF. The signal, the voltage, goes as the time derivative of the change in flux. And so it's proportional to frequency. So if you go, if you're trying to measure 5 orders of magnitude in frequency, you're going to have a 10^5 less signal at the lowest frequency. So this is really not very good for measurements at, let's say, 1 hertz and below. And so what we did was we used a squid. And this is basically a description of how the squid works, but it's a flux to voltage converter. If you then balance the flux at this optimal point, you get a maximum change in voltage. So we set up a feedback loop that makes us sit at this point. And so this is, oops, this is our circuit. What we have is this gradiometer. We put the sample in here. These are all exploded. These all go concentric. And we have a balance coil over here. We have a superconducting flux transformer. A superconducting flux transformer has conserved the number of flux within the loop, and so it gives us no loss. We're not measuring induced EMF, and so what we have is a flat frequency response down to the lowest frequencies. And at high frequencies, because all these coils have only very, very small number of turns, instead of, let's say, 2,000 turns, these coils here might have 10 turns, and this has 300 turns, so the intercoil resonance is much less. These resistances are small, so then this has broadband, a flat frequency response to higher frequencies of, you know, tens and hundreds, and we can go to 500 kilohertz if we wanted to, but we didn't push that to that frequency range. So in the meantime, the Janssen group and Barbara's group, they came up with a squid measurement where they measured the magnetization while sweeping a frequency, or sorry, sweeping the field. And so what they did was they looked at this magnetization, and they look at the nonlinear term, and they're trying to see whether this is a spin glass or not. And what they concluded was is that the chi double, the harmonic of the susceptibility did not diverge as would be expected for a spin glass. And so then they said that the 16% was not a spin glass, and it did not have a phase transition, where Reich said. And so then the Rosenbaum group disagreed with that and said that likely the Janssen group was sweeping too quickly. And what happens is if they're sweeping between 1 and 50 oersteds per second, and they're going to 150 oersteds, then they're doing this sweep within 3 to 150 seconds. And so that could be too fast. So we did our measurement, and what we see as a function of temperature with our squid, we can, this is the chi prime and the chi double prime as a function of frequency. We're seeing the susceptibility flatten out. So this is the static part over here, the static limit. And then what we see is the frequency going to lower frequencies for chi double prime. When we do the normalizing, well, I'll show you the next slide, we're going to see that there's no funny asymmetry like they see over here. And if we compare the results of, let's say, for example, 120 hertz, the frequency at which this occurs is very similar to what the Reich's work has, but it's very different from the Gauche's work. So this is actually something we only noticed later once we had our data, that the Rosenbaum group actually disagrees between themselves. They have the same sample, and they have about a factor of 10 difference in their frequency. We also look at this, and it looks pretty non-asymmetric, while over here they're seeing an asymmetry. Okay, so this is where we normalize it, and we see as a broadening of the spectrum what we would expect for a spin glass, just like what Reich saw for his 16%. But for the 4.5, they saw it going backwards. So we disagree with Reich when it comes to the width of the temperature dependence. And this is the Gauche's one. And so over here.
Right.
I'm not sure what you're saying. So the thing is, the width here is backwards from, it's equivalent
narrowing.
It's narrowing. Yeah, that's why I put this mark here. This is 300 milli-K, and this is 150. So they're seeing narrowing. This doesn't look as asymmetric, but they still do see narrowing. So what's kind of funny is that we're agreeing with the peak frequency position of Reich, but we're not agreeing with the narrowing aspect. And so over here, I'm going to wrap up soon. But basically what happens here with we did a fit to our data of the time constant that we're extracting or defining of the peak of the chi double prime. This allows us to get a signature of the time constant of the system down to the lowest temperatures. It's not the ideal way of doing it, but it's good for, it's not the standard way, but I think it's a good way for the data we have. Okay, so what happens, we have this the time constant scaled with an Arrhenius behavior, and we can see at the lowest temperatures there's a small deviation, but it fits pretty well. This over here is the Gauche work, and you can see a significant deviation, but with the Reich work, they're actually matching up very nicely. So we agree with Rosenbaum's original work, and we're not agreeing with his later work. And then over here, we have a different scaling, assuming it's a spin glass, and this is the kind of analysis that Reich et al. Did for their other concentrations. And what we see here is that at the lower temperature, as we approach a spin glass transition, that this is fitting very nicely. At higher temperatures, there's a small deviation, which maybe is to be expected, because we're pretty far away from the spin glass transition. Unfortunately, we can't get very close to the spin glass transition because the time scales are becoming so long. This data here was taken we needed to go down to a millihertz to be able to get that. And because of this time constant with this power of 7 here, if we wanted to go closer in, we'd have to go to frequencies that are two orders of magnitude higher, let's say, if we wanted to point up here, and that would start interfering with things like, helium transfers in the refrigerator would start interfering with the data. So this is the best we can do. and I think what would be good to do, well, we're definitely doing this, we have it loaded right now, is we're going to be going to higher concentrations, like the 8% concentration that we have, to look for the similar kind of scaling behavior. Because the glass transition should be higher, we should be able to get closer. Okay, so this is looking at the chi prime, and what we see here is that we have good agreement with Reich. And then what we see here is the Janssen work and how they get a roll-off. What we're plotting here is our chi prime as a function of the maximum chi prime we get as a function of different frequencies. And so as we go to lower frequencies, we see that we can extend to lower temperatures. And this deviation, this roll-off here, is because that chi prime is, that we're determining is not really in a static limit. And so this roll-off here is actually not appropriate. The static limit is still following a nice 1 over T behavior. And what we see is Janssen's work, which is not an AC oscillation but a sweep, is agreeing with ours but also has a roll-off. And so I think that Rosenbaum's group is correct in saying that they're sweeping too fast. And if you're looking at a time constant of a full sweep in 1 second to 150 seconds, that's much faster than what we're doing at a millihertz oscillation. And so this is consistent with what we would expect. And the work by Ghosh et al. Had a power law like this, which none of us agree with, including, let's say, the theory of Biltmore and Nelius.
Is the Biltmore curve an absolute scale, or is it moved up sideways?
You're saying did they normalize it to something here? I don't know. I'm not sure. No, I don't know. And so one of the things we had there was a meeting in Toronto in around October, and Gabe Apley, one of the authors and workers in the group with Rosenbaum, was there. And what they were proposing for the, being the difference between the measurements is that it could be that the Janssen work and our work is using thin slivers while they're using a block or a chunk. And so they thought maybe there could be something to do with the geometry. And so what we did was we measured another sample with the same exact aspect ratio as theirs. I really didn't think that would be the case, but you know, we should just do it, so we did. And we can see that we have very similar results. This has just come out recently, and we have to do a correction for the demagnetization and also do a calibration for the sensitivity of the susceptometer. But in general, we're seeing the same result. And this is the Ghosh work. And then if we compare our work with the Reich work, we can see that our data actually, and these are now demagnetization correction was done, we actually have very nice agreement for the 120 millik. And what's funny is that they don't show that data in their PRB when they do the normalizing for the broadening effect. For that, they're only looking at the higher temperature, and they excluded this one from that graph. But we have good agreement with the one data curve that they didn't like for some reason. And then Ghosh over here has this very unusual result. Okay, so in conclusion, I think that what we're seeing is that we're seeing the scaling says we have a 43 millik spin glass transition in the 4.5%. We're going to be going to higher concentrations and lower to see what we can get with the susceptibility. I should mention that Gingras has a very serious simulation work that took a lot of computer power to do a calculations of the spin glass transitions, and found that for a 6.5% compound that there would be a spin glass transition at 43 millik. And I guess I'll just stop here. If you have any questions, we can we'll talk now or afterwards in the break. Thanks. Yeah, I think we can come up with a couple of things, but they're not. Might as well get to it. Yeah. One of the things is that I should have stayed there. Basically, there's a heat capacity. There's a big background subtraction being done. And the heat capacity is becoming very large right in that temperature range. And so if they have their sample glued onto this substrate, then the time constant between that sample and the substrate, which goes to specific heat over that thermal link, is actually the longest at that point. And so it means that the heat getting into the sample will be the most inaccurate at that point. And so actually, once you do the background subtraction, it doesn't seem so extreme, but there's a very large background, and the heat capacity is becoming very large there. And so that would be consistent with an underestimate of the specific heat at that peak area. And then if their background subtraction isn't done right, then it could even look like it's zero, right, in the specific heat zero at that point. So I would say that it's not that they're peaks, it's actually that there's a valley. And then the background subtraction is done to make that valley look like it went to zero. That's what I think. I think that's another thing, is that the background subtraction is a really important thing, for example, for this entropy calculation. And what we should do is probably go to the pure material and try to get a better measurement of that background and understanding of it. And also, there's maybe some significant assumptions being made about what that background really is. The way we're doing it is we're looking at pure holmium lithium fluoride, and then calculating the background from that and assuming it's the same at the lower concentrations, which may be not the case. Oh, the simulations, I think that...
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's something that probably Michel Gingras, who's right here, could probably describe better. But my understanding? Well, so what happens with Claire Yu's calculation, well, she has they have a cubic lattice. And so there's some problems with that simulation in that the angles of the holmiums are not... really described properly. And so the thing is if you have neighbors like this, then you're going to end up having an antiferromagnetic interaction. While over here, you'll have ferromagnetic. So I think that the estimates of, let's say, the concentration dependence for Claire's work that says there's no spin glass transition would probably be wrong. So the work is not wrong. She's using cubic, but it probably does not apply to the system properly, because she doesn't have the distributions of the angles proper and the kind of the frustration. And I would say that just the other thing I know, oh, Michelle's say Thanks.
But it's all a classical spin glass.
Yeah, it's just a simulation of the dipolar IC. It's the same identity that contains the
Thank you.